When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision?
Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI.
Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
During the summertime when the weather gets hot, I can only imagine how much time you plan to spend outside with friends and family or on your couch with that AC blasting. AT&T 5G and home internet keeps you connected, whether you're at home or on the go, so you can stay connected to your loved ones and to your favorite things. Whether you're sharing pics from the best rooftops, video calling your friends from an outdoor concert, or streaming your favorite show, episode after episode after episode. So connect at home or on the move with AT&T 5G and home internet and create memories and more all summer long. AT&T 5G requires compatible plan and device. Coverage not available everywhere. Learn more at att.com/5G for you.
Tired of routine Walgreens trips? Get rewarded for shopping with Drop. With Drop, you can earn free gift cards on groceries, gas, and more. Download Drop now and use code DROP55 to get $5 in points. Join Drop today.
Dealing with pests can be a pain, but relax, Terminix can help.
Because when pests show up, so does Terminix.
With over 95 years of experience, they have what it takes to take on any pest problem fast.
If your home or business has pests, don't stress it.
Terminix it.
Visit Terminix.com to book your appointment online today.
That's TERMINIX.com.
From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. We're pretty excited about today's episode, folks, because we're diving into something that is near and dear to our hearts and hopefully to yours, especially nowadays with the U.S. government admitting that there are unknown things somewhere out there in the sky. That's right. We're talking about UFOs, but we are not examining this alone. We're talking about a very specific story of UFO encounters, and we're doing it with the help of the one and only Toby Ball, investigative journalist, podcaster, the creator of Strange Arrivals. Strange Arrivals Season 2 is out now as you listen to today's show. Toby, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me back.
That's right. You're our returning guest. I think Saturday Night Live rules say once you hit number 5, we have to give you a jacket.
You are on a short list, my friend. We don't have that many returning guests. I don't know if it's because they don't want to come back or what. No, I'm kidding. But no, it's very, very excited to have you back. And such a cool way of extending what you did in the first season of Strange Arrivals with this, you know, very familiar story, but I think one that's not familiar in terms of like how it sits in the overall lore of UFO sightings.
Well, yeah, let's get into that, Toby. The Rendlesham Forest incident is known by a lot of people as kind of the Roswell incident of the UK. So why don't you just tell us what it is, like overall, what happened, what supposedly happened, and then we'll get into what you found throughout your season.
Yeah, it's the Roswell of the UK. It's an encounter that takes place over 3 nights. There's actually the first and the third night are sort of major nights. The second night, there's a little something that happens. But essentially, the first night is Christmas night on 1980. And I should take a step back. This all takes place in Rendlesham Forest, which is a forest that's in between 2 Royal Air Force bases, Bentwaters and Woodbridge. And they're both sort of technically under the control of the British Air Force. In fact, they're U.S. Air Force bases. And Bentwaters actually has nuclear weapons. So this is 1980. It's the height of the Cold War. So, you know, it's Christmas night. It's not a whole lot going on. There's sort of a routine patrol around the perimeter. And one of the two people in the Jeep, this guy, Bud Steffens, sees a light in the sky that descends into the forest, just a matter of maybe a quarter mile from where they're driving. And he asks the guy who's with him, whose name is John Burroughs. He says, you know, have you ever seen anything like that? Burroughs says, I haven't. And they see a light coming from the forest. They're not sure what to do because the forest is actually off base. So they don't have clearance to go out there. They call into headquarters. Headquarters sends this guy, Jim Peniston, who's slightly higher ranking, and a couple of other people to meet them at this gate. So they get there and they talk it over and they think that maybe it's a plane crash. That seems to be the best explanation they can come up with that limited data. And they decide what they need to do is to go off base, go into the woods to see, you know, if they're survivors, see what the situation is. So they leave their weapons with Steffens, and three of them take off in a Jeep, drive the Jeep as far as they can into the forest, and then proceed on foot. They have trouble with their radios. They leave one guy, this guy Ed Cabansag, sort of as a relay in between the Jeep and where they're going. They see this light coming at them through the forest. And then so Burroughs and Peniston approach the light. Apparently the light gets brighter. They dive behind like this berm, like this raised area of ground. And then the stories sort of diverge slightly. And I'll give you the sort of less involved version, which is, and this is Burroughs' version, is that they get up and they see the light is receding through the trees and they follow it. And they don't actually see a craft, but they keep following this light and they go out into a field, which is near like this very, very small village. And the light continues to go away. They try and follow it. They don't catch it. They eventually turn around. And as they're coming back, they see another set of lights in the forest. And this is sort of a blue and white set of lights. And at that point, they return to base and report in. So that's the first night. And I assume we'll wait, and I'll tell the longer Peniston story.
Yeah, later. Okay. This is a great scene setting for sure.
I already have so many questions, yes. And I'm sure that the audience does as well. So one of the things our fellow conspiracy realists are always interested in when we hear specific details or timelines of high-profile UFO UAP sightings is the point where the stories diverge. In your previous work on season one of Strange Arrivals, with the Betty and Barney Hill case, you had really dug in and found those intersection points, right, of differences in reports, differences in opinion or speculation. But one thing that's different about this is that, as you had mentioned to us earlier when we're chatting off air, this event occurred in the 80s. So there are people alive and lucid who have personal experience or firsthand experience with this. When you were talking with people and found these divergent points in the story, Toby, did people seem to agree to disagree? Was there anyone saying like, no, insert person here has their facts wrong? Or were they just saying, well, that's how I remember it?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. The three people I interviewed, who are really the three main voices on Rendlesham, of the people who actually had encounters. So that's Chuck Holt, who we haven't talked about yet, John Burroughs, and Jim Peniston. I mean, they've all worked together on things and worked separately on things. And as time has gone on, you know, certainly in Peniston's situation and Halt's to a somewhat lesser extent, Burroughs not so much. Like their stories have changed slightly. And I think there is, and I talk about this a little bit in the podcast, and I don't think it's like in a malicious way, but there's a sense of who owns the story, right? Like who owns your experience. So when I talked to them, there was a little bit of that guy doesn't know what he's talking about. Oh, I don't know. That guy kind of panicked. And as we'll, I'm sure, talk about in a little bit, you know, this guy was stuck in suspended animation and didn't experience this thing. So I'm the only person who actually knows what happened, you know. So and it was with different levels. I mean, there are books involved. So there are two of the people were kind of sort of either, I wouldn't say accused each other of lying, but of not having the facts straight and sort of promoting a narrative that wasn't borne out by what actually happened.
Yeah, so this is something you get into later in the season. I don't want to spoil too much, but this is a major theme, I think, of the show. Competing narratives and motivation for having a separate narrative.
Right.
A lot of the diverging information seems to come when television producers, or, you know, a lot of times television producers or somebody else comes through and is interviewing one of these individuals for a high profile show. And then it seems as though maybe the stories really begin to diverge that way. We've talked on this show before how, you know, a producer a lot of times has a need to have the most compelling story possible. And the lines between, you know, what is nonfiction and fiction blur a little bit in their needs. So like, and it also goes into some of the government's motivations for some of the things that happen later in the season. So in your mind, do you think these guys, when you're talking to them, do you get a sense that they believe like their own story so much so that it's truth to them, or that, did you get a sense that maybe there's something else going on there?
Oh, Halt for sure does.
So when I talked to John Burroughs, I feel like his story has been fairly consistent. He kind of talks about what he knows and what he doesn't know. You know, he has some thoughts about what it actually was, which, I don't know how accurate that is. And Chuck Halt, I feel like he feels very strongly. And what's kind of interesting about his story is that he kind of sticks to the story, but like these things that get mentioned kind of in passing at the time take on new life. You know, it becomes a little more dramatic than it was when he first talked about it in, you know, late 1980, early 1981. Penniston has a whole new narrative line that pops up well after the fact. And so I can't judge on how sincere he is or anything like that, but it is something that really kind of pops up out of nowhere. And again, it actually, the critical moment, as you were talking about, it comes when they're taping, I think it's Ancient Aliens maybe, but one of those shows, and it's on camera. Like there's a clip of it that you can find. I don't know if you can find it on the internet, but somebody shared it with me to show me like what happened. And it's, he finds this binary code in this notebook while they're filming. And that's kind of the key moment to this next, like, longer, completely strange narrative that he tells.
And this is really important because this is something that we discussed in season one in our interview, which is there's this dilemma between perceived sincerity and just the treacherous nature of memory. Right. And in your work as an investigative crime reporter, I'm sure you've seen eyewitnesses get things wrong, but not because they're trying to be misleading. It's simply because every time you remember something, you're remembering the last time you remembered it. So with this, the reason I wanted to ask originally about how people treated these different divergent narratives or opinions is because that is one of the things that, you know, like the hardcore skeptics really hinge on when they talk about any kind of inexplicable encounter. But I don't want to disrupt our timeline too much because I know a lot of us are listening at home or possibly in a spacecraft and wondering, well, hey, what happened on day two?
So day two is actually not a ton happens. There's a brief encounter where a car is on patrol. It's not even clear if there are one or two people in the car. And a light actually goes inside the car. and, you know, so traumatizes the woman officer who's in the car, whose name I'm forgetting at the moment, that, you know, she's taken off duty and is actually, I think, leaves Bentwaters, goes to another base. I tried to track her down without success. I heard from somebody else that she kind of is laying low and not talking about this. But that was really the only thing that happened. Like, I don't even know if that would be much of a story if it wasn't bridging nights one and night three. But night three is the next night when there's like a big encounter that's seen by a whole bunch of people.
So you mentioned this other person, Halt. Now, can you describe who that person is and what they did to add to what we know about this incident?
Okay, so Chuck Halt was the deputy base commander. So he was fairly high up in the hierarchy on base. So there was a party, which would be the night of the 27th, and the base brass are there. And, you know, an airman comes in and says, the lights are back. And so there's some conversation. And, you know, people, for the most part, don't want to deal with it. Like, I don't think it was taken so seriously. So as it's been put to me, Chuck Halt got the short straw. So he has to, like, pull together a group of people to go out into the forest to see what's going on. So he gets a group, including this guy, Morgan Nevels, who apparently is sort of a photography enthusiast. And so he gets brought along thinking that maybe he'd take some pictures. They get night vision goggles. And there's some question about whether they had been trained on them and knew exactly what they did. A Geiger counter. And they tromp off into the woods to try and figure out what's going on. At the same time, John Burroughs has been hanging out with some of his buddies on base, and they decide to go out and check it out for themselves too. So you've got these two groups who kind of, they eventually meet in the forest. Halt, you know, he goes to where his understanding of the original landing spot was. They see this light through the trees. He takes some Geiger counter readings. My understanding is that even though it wasn't, you know, at zero or whatever, that it was basically normal background radiation. They use the night vision goggles, which increases light 20,000 times or something. So he, through the night vision goggles, in addition to be like nearly blinded by how bright things are, he thinks he sees a little bit more detail. It looks like an eye looking at him. But the light keeps coming and disappearing. And they do the same thing, right? They kind of try to follow the light. They go out into the field. The light is sort of receding from them. And then they see what they think are a whole bunch of lights in the sky, probably above Bentwaters Air Base. And they watch it for quite a long time, are reporting back, aren't getting much back from headquarters, wondering if there's radar on any of these things, not getting anything back on that. And eventually they're just cold and tired, and they leave.
And you have an actual recording of that occurrence, right?
Right. So Halt, I didn't mention this, but when Halt goes out, he brings a tape recorder, like a 1980s tape recorder. And so he's taping what he considers to be important moments, because he's only got so much tape, right, and batteries. So he's turning it on and off and on and off and on and off. It's this real-time record of these moments while they're watching it. And you can tell, I mean, they're not, doesn't sound like they're faking it. They honestly don't know what's going on. And they're kind of freaked out about it, but not scared. I mean, Halt is just, you know, he's kind of laughing in amazement at what's going on around him. They come back and they report in, and eventually the Air Force, the people who are in charge, the Americans, don't really know what to make of it. In all honesty, one of the things that's interesting about the official response is it seems like they're never really all that concerned. But because you have American service people marching around off base in the middle of the night, there needs to be some kind of explanation. And so the base commander has Halt write a memo that he's going to give to the Royal Air Force guy who's like sort of technically in charge of the base, sort of explaining what was happening, right? And so this is, you know, this is the morning, early morning of the 28th. So we're still in the holidays. So this base commander is actually off, I believe, in Wales, like visiting family for the holidays. So Halt writes this memo. It's just one page. I think there's 4 points that he makes, and he's sort of detailing both what happened on the first night, for as far as he's heard, and then what he actually witnessed. So he writes it, but then he waits until this guy comes back from vacation, like days and days and days, like more than a week, and then he gives it to him. And so that's another thing that will come up later. It's like, well, you know, if you thought, you know, aliens or whatever were, you know, penetrating this nuclear airbase, why didn't you like call the guy and like tell him right away that this was going on? Why did you wait like a week and a half to give him this information? Like, it doesn't seem like you were taking it too seriously.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, reading that memo, which is publicly available now, I think since 1983, under an FOIA, reading this memo was really fascinating because the title makes you wonder just how many memos these guys get. The title is literally Unexplained Lights, you know, 2 weeks later or whatever. And with this, what's fascinating is when, you know, when we hear FOI requests, the assumption for a lot of people is that it means whatever document was given was top secret or compartmentalized. But from my understanding, the memo itself was not actually classified, and the response did seem somewhat lackluster, especially considering the concerns you would have about any kind of security around a nuclear base. In your opinion, when Halt, as you said, pulls the short straw and goes out and he has this equipment and he notices that there's something amiss, did he initially come to a conclusion that there was something extraterrestrial occurring? Because I believe that he has gone on record afterwards saying that he personally believes he saw something extraterrestrial. Do you think that was one of his initial conclusions or something he arrived at over time? Because again, the memo is just like, there are lights and we don't know why or how.
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know if I have a definitive answer on that. I mean, I think looking back at it, Halt sort of implies that he did at the time, but I don't know if that's actually the case. And again, I think there's this strange lack of urgency that you think if he was 100% committed at that time to its extraterrestrials hovering above our nuclear weapons, that he would push a little bit harder to get that to the people who needed to see it. And that just didn't happen. And again, that gap in time is something that, you know, skeptics point to, and that the military at the time, like the government of Great Britain or United Kingdom, that was one of the things they said. It's like, we didn't take it seriously because they didn't take it seriously. Like, the people who did the report didn't think it was serious enough to bother somebody during vacation. Like, they waited until they came back. So, you know, I mean, I run across things in my job that I don't think are that important, but I would call my boss.
Sure.
You know? And it doesn't have to do with aliens and nuclear weapons.
Well, I mean, you know, for example, we always talk about these disembodied lights, this being kind of like a hallmark of classic UFO sightings. And the Phoenix Lights, I think, is one of the more recent ones that we've talked about on the show. I actually just realized that it's pretty funny. Kurt Russell, the actor, was the civilian pilot who actually spotted the Phoenix Lights and reported them. I don't know if we talked about that in the episode. So, but I was looking it up and it came up. He just kind of casually mentioned it in a BBC interview, but he was flying his son to like visit his son's girlfriend or something. And he saw this like V-shaped array of lights and he called it in. So, I mean, you know, like it seems like something you would definitely escalate, especially if you were in charge of overseeing things of that nature, like nuclear weapons or nuclear facilities. But I'm wondering, you know, Ben, you made a really good point early on in this interview about how this was in the 80s. So there was a lot more stuff out there in terms of reports of these kinds of sightings, in terms of pop culture, like the Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out in 1977. I'm just wondering if, like, you think any of that stuff fed into or detracted maybe from the stories or from these folks' willingness to report them. Maybe they thought because there was all this stuff out there, they would be seen as quacks or something if they, like, you know, reported anything of that nature.
That's a good question. I know that Peniston in particular, but all three of them kind of mentioned that like reporting that you saw UFOs was not really a path to success right. in the Air Force.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's that angle to it, but I also think there's the angle that it's out there. Like you see strange lights. One of the possibilities is, you know, alien visitation. And would that have happened in like 1972 before Close Encounters and before some of this other stuff was in the air? I don't know. And then when you find out what the skeptics, the kind of the explanation for it is, would you be more open to that explanation even at the time if you didn't have in the back of your mind, oh man, this may be, you know, extraterrestrial craft that we're encountering?
Well, so it's this context that you can kind of exist within, where it was before that just wasn't there. And it was just kind of like WTF. But now it's like, okay, there's a calculus that goes into this decision at this point, where based on what we know, what's been reported, what's out there, what, you know, in pop culture and cinema and TV and stuff, it's like, how does this make me look? You know, because there really is like a much more concrete understanding and a divide, right, between the skeptics and the believers at this point in time.
Well, yeah, and I think when you add the fact that it's, you know, it's in the military, mm-hmm. And the military has gone through, you know, the Air Force in particular has gone through this whole process with Project Blue Book that ended, you know, about 10 years before, and it's sort of officially, we're not dealing with UFOs anymore. If you see anything, you report it to your local authorities, don't report it to us. And then when you have people who are part of the Air Force saying, oh, we were tromping around in the woods and we saw this light and, you know, we think it's extraterrestrials. You know, I think that's kind of a head scratcher. It's, you know, it's like, why is this happening? Why are you telling me this? What do you want me to do about it? Because we officially, like, you got to take it up with a different authority.
Side note, Toby, thank you for putting officially in there, right? Yeah. Some things would later come to light. We'll pause for a word from our sponsor and we'll be back with Toby Ball.
The following is a high five moment from highfivecasino.com.
Welcome to Burger Yippee. Would you like a hot apple pie today?
Yes, yes, yeah, I won! Woohoo!
So that's a yes on the apple pie?
I just went big time playing High Five Casino on my phone. Real cash prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. Woo!
So yes or no on the apple pie?
Woo! I won again!
I'll take that as a yes. Drive around.
Have you had your high five moment today? Only at highfivecasino.com.
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X, and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
And we're back with more from Toby Ball on Strange Arrivals Season 2.
there's so much to talk about specifically with the Rendlesham Forest incident, but I kind of want people to have the revelations in the middle of your podcast rather than this one, specifically from the skeptic angle. Mm-hmm. Episode 3 in particular is one where it feels like your eyes get opened to a lot of data that wasn't available when the original stories are happening.
A lot of data, line of sight from the east.
Yeah. And you'll get it from the title of episode 3 that I'm not even going to say on this episode. Mm-hmm. You mentioned some of the other Project Blue Book and everything that kind of culminated up to before this 1980 occurrence. You talk a lot about J. Allen Hynek and the kind of the civilian part of the UFO information gathering that was done by the U.S. government. I want to talk about him a little bit, specifically in regards to the Encounters system that he created. You'll be familiar with this, Close Encounters of the First, Second, and Third Kind, as well as the additions that came later, the Fourth Kind and the Fifth Kind. And I can't remember, Toby, if last time we talked with you, we had already talked with Stephen Greer or not, but we had him on the show to discuss the Fifth Kind, which, whoo, buddy, it's a whole thing. But specifically, I want to ask you about Hynek, again, the guy that created this thing. Why was he so interested in Close Encounters of the Second Kind, which is, I think, how you would describe the Rendlesham Forest incident?
Yeah, it's probably kind of fall in between the first and the second. So the Close Encounters of the Second Kind are not just sort of visual sightings, but also involve some kind of physical evidence. And that's, you know, again, it's not like a tail fin being found, because we would know about that, right? That would be a big deal. But it's things like burned brush, or there are markings on the ground where something might have landed. Sometimes people may get something that looks like a sunburn, or like scrapes, or what have you. So that was one of the things that with Rendlesham is there did seem to be some physical evidence in addition to the sightings, and that's there looked like there might have been some markings on the ground where a thing might have landed or sort of been rooted to the spot by some other forces. And they saw some stuff through the night vision goggles that where the trees seemed to glow and give off some kind of emanation. It's kind of interesting in that this guy Ian Ridpath, who is a astronomer and a journalist, you know, he went and talked to the forester who lived in Rendlesham Forest, a guy whose name is improbably Vincent Thurkettle. Yeah. And
amazing. Yeah.
And then so Thurkettle, like, kind of comes up, is sort of like, well, you know, and I guess we're not giving away what sort of the large answer is.
Give away whatever you want to give away. I was cautious.
Yeah. No, I get it. So I would leave you to, for the big story, you can listen to episode 3. But for instance, for these like supposed like landing spots, he looks at it, he's like, look, those are like squirrel diggings or rabbit diggings. You know, that's what it looks like when a rabbit is digging for food. It leaves these spots. It's not, you know, an 8,000-pound, you know, extraterrestrial craft landing. So,
yeah but is he sure?
Okay, or maybe he's just covering it up, you know.
He's part of it.
He's been communicating with them for years.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite observations where when it comes to that close encounter kind, which is a great question, Matt, there's this line where it may have been Thurkettle or someone associated with him and says, yes, there are broken branches in that area, because that's in a forest, and forests have broken branches, which I thought was like, I thought was just enough snark, you know, to be the educational forester. But one thing that's interesting with this guy, with Thurkettle, is that he, from what I understand, he received a visit from some folks before he himself was like made aware of what had happened. There's this incident, I think it's, yeah, it's December, of course. And he says that it was later in December when some people came to ask him some questions, like almost Men in Black style. And what he said is that, you know, the kind of the same vibe he has throughout a lot of things. He said, I didn't know what they were talking about. And then later I found out, and apparently he still wasn't sure who those folks were, but
I know who they were. They were, right. They were a Majestic 12 for sure.
There we go. But I want to ask too, because, there's another person that we could maybe introduce here, because we talked about Halt, how he doesn't shy away now or, you know, later from his opinion of what he witnessed, but he is this is not a unanimous opinion. Whether or not the storylines diverge, it appears there were some folks who were pretty skeptical. There was one that stood out to me, Colonel Ted Conrad, who said that, I'm just picking him as one example of somebody who disputed the testimony of the men who encountered these sightings. Do you feel that these sightings get kind of shut down as a matter of course in these sorts of investigations? I mean, given, like you said, Project Blue Book closing down, given the fact that it was heavily implied this might not be the best thing for your career. Do you think there were any fears of like recrimination or ridicule when these guys are reporting this stuff?
On the part of the Air Force or on the part of these individuals?
On the part of these individuals reporting to their superiors.
Yeah. My sense, and part of it comes from talking to Jim McGahey, who was also in the Air Force and did some investigation of his own on this stuff, is, and also just from what you see in the official reaction, is that nobody took it that seriously, right? I think they thought, here are these guys, they saw something, it's not something we have to worry about. And I think what Conrad, if I'm remembering this correctly, you know, part of what he really objects to is Halt in particular, but Peniston and Burroughs too, sort of accusing them of a cover-up. And he's like, you know, you should be ashamed to say that. Because you think something happened and we didn't doesn't mean we're covering it up. It's just, you know, you're deluded and we aren't. I think is the Air Force's take on it. So Peniston makes a comment. I don't know if it made it to the series or not, where afterwards he had sort of a guy who sort of was like his guardian angel in the Air Force and kind of made sure that things went well for him. And I think that was, you know, it wasn't really in exchange for keeping quiet about things, but it's sort of an acknowledgement that he had experienced something that kind of went above and beyond what would be expected. Again, this is just something he said. Like, I've got no confirmation or evidence that it actually happened, but it was part of this larger story that he tells about Rendlesham that nobody else can confirm.
Do locals in the area at this time in the early 80s, do locals in the area respond? How do the civilians that are living, you know, roughly nearby, how do they digest or encounter the story of this sighting, as in, like, when do they learn about it? Or is it treated skeptically? Is it treated the way the Air Force is treating it, I guess,
yeah.
I'm asking.
You know, I don't know for sure. You know, in 1983, when it comes out in the London tabloids, I think that would be the first time they would hear about it. I don't know, like, in the years that immediately followed, what the feeling was. I know there were some local people who were sort of UFO interested to begin with, who you did some investigation as you would expect. And now I guess it's another way where it's a little bit like Britain's Roswell, where it's, you know, you hit all these anniversaries and there's stories about it and there's still stories. I think I mentioned it in one of the episodes where I was just going through like the last years, you know, just doing a Google search on, you know, British newspapers and the last year's worth of Rendlesham stories, and they're still, you know, they're still coming up with with theories about what happened. And I was actually interviewed by BBC Sussex, I think, about the podcast. So I think there's still interest, but I think it's more as a weird piece of local history more than we were visited by aliens.
And maybe folklore at this point.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
One of the reasons I'm asking that is because what we've found in cases like Roswell and in other cases, not even necessarily UFO related, ostensibly, we found that when they happen in more isolated or slightly rural areas, that locals tend to latch on to these things as a way of sort of distinguishing their community or area, up to and including creating a tourist industry. So that's why I was asking what their consideration there was.
Yeah, I don't, you know, there is a, you know, I believe Bentwaters is shut down and Woodbridge might be as well, but there is like a UFO trail in Rendlesham Forest and they've got a model of what, you know, the craft was described as. And, you know, I think they have a little plaque and stuff. But if you go, if you look at Rendlesham Forest UFO and on Google and you go to the images, it's like kids climbing all over this, this model UFO. It's, so that's, I think that's, it's not like Roswell where they have, you know, UFO festivals and, you know, UFO theme parks or whatever. I mean, I don't know exactly what Roswell has, but I know that that's, it's a UFO tourist destination.
And with that, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
The following is a high five moment from HighFiveCasino.com.
I won! Yahoo! Private, put down your phone. This is the army.
Sort. High Five Casino is a social casino. It's on your phone. Goes wherever you go. I win free spins, cash, prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. I won again.
Platoon, present cell phone. High Five.
High Five.
Casino.
Casino.
Win at HighFiveCasino.com.
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire. With the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
I bet you're smart.
Yeah, and you like to hold your own in the group chat.
We can help you drop even more knowledge. My name is Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Izadi. We host a daily news podcast called Post Reports.
Every weekday afternoon, Post Reports takes you inside an important and interesting story with the kind of reporting that you can only get from The Washington Post.
You can listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. Go find it now and hit follow.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
And we have returned.
So I want to blow this out a little bit more, even further, just from the Rendlesham Forest incident, because you end up following so many trails as you go throughout your season. You speak with these legendary figures, dude, in the world of UFO, people that we've been talking about and thinking about for a long time. Perhaps personally for me, one of the most compelling people you talk to is this guy named Richard C. Doty. And when you hear that name, that might ring a bell. We've discussed him before with regards to a documentary from 2013 called Mirage Men, to some of the weird stuff going on between, I think it was Bill Moore and, oh gosh, who's the person that was like being fed information from
Paul
Bill
Benowitz?
Moore? Paul Benowitz, my goodness. Okay, so there's this whole like world of UFO lore that exists around this guy. When you're talking to him, you describe him, first of all, as a former professional counterintelligence agent. I want to know if there's anything that didn't make it into the podcast that he told you that was just too extraordinary, or you just couldn't believe, or you're like, that's definitely disinfo. Just anything that you encountered that you didn't put in.
Yeah, so I talked to him for about 2 hours, and so there was a lot of stuff, you know, and I kind of signposted, hopefully, well enough, because I think a lot of what he was telling me was sort of consistent and compatible with the disinformation that he'd been passing back in the 80s. Like, he's not changing his story and saying, well, I, you know, this is the reality and this is what I was telling people. He's continuing those stories. I'll tell you the one thing that I wrestled with whether to put this in, and I actually wrote half an episode about this, and then I just decided this is getting too far outside of the scope. But I don't know if you guys have covered this, but Project Serpo, do you know about this?
So, we haven't done it on air, but yeah, I mean, okay. I have a passing awareness, yes.
So Project Serpo, and I'm not going to remember the name of the guy who ran this sort of UFO email listserv thing, but he got this email from a guy who was supposedly, you know, quote unquote, a government insider, who was leaking, according to him, information about this secret project. And it kind of goes way back to like the sort of context to it goes way back to Roswell, where they say, you know, we recovered a live alien called Eben, I think is what they called him. And so they bring him and he's kept for a number of years, and they recover a communication device from one of the UFOs, and they get it back working again. And he communicates back to his home planet and like asks them to come and get him. And then they send a group to come and get him. But this alien has died in the meantime. But they come and there's a meeting and there's an agreement put in place where there's going to be like this exchange program where we are going to send 12 either military people or astronauts, it's not entirely clear to me which, back to this planet where these aliens come from. And it's a planet that's codenamed by us. I don't know if it's what the aliens call it, but it's called Serpo. So in the late 60s, I believe, I'm not going to remember the exact date, we send 12 people, I think it's 10 men and 2 women, on this spaceship off to this planet, sort of like Close Encounters, right? The end of Close Encounters, where people getting on the spaceship. So they go there, and apparently it's this planet that's largely sort of these small communities. You know, it's got, you know, 600,000 residents or something. It's a little bit smaller than Earth. It's got these small communities, although there is like a central government of some sort. And there's this whole story about how they got into a war, interplanetary war, thousands of years ago, and all this stuff. Anyway, it's crazy, right? And then, so 2 of the people died on Serpo. 2 decided they liked Serpo so much they were just going to stay there. So 8 returned to Earth. And Serpo is in the Zeta Reticuli system, which has 2 suns. So apparently the radiation from 2 suns caused like these tremendous health problems for the astronauts who returned. And I think the last one supposedly died in like the early 2000s. But anyway, so Doty was telling me this story, and you know, I guess not surprisingly, he's been kind of accused of being the guy behind the story. And he was saying, no, 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 it wasn't me. It was this other guy. And I went with Bill Moore and we met with him and he denied it, but it's pretty clear that it's him. But he said he talked to Doty, told me, you know, I talked to my sources and they said, yeah, you know, some of the details are wrong, but the basics of the story that we sent astronauts to this planet Serpo and then they came back and all this stuff, he's like, that's all accurate. Like that's all based on truth.
What?
Yeah. So, yeah. But it is one of those, you know, it's interesting. And then you're like, okay, so you're a disinformation agent and this is what you're laying on me, right? And I think it's, you know, it's in the context of when he was first putting that stuff out there and what people believed at the time, and especially these like people who are deep, deep, deep into the UFO culture, right? What would they believe? And then I think like pushing it to extremes, because you want people to believe that they have like the absolute insider knowledge of what's going on.
That's the whole, my whole question is leading up to why, what advantage does that kind of disinformation give to the United States government? Because that's where it would be originating from, right? An agent of the intelligence community of the United States government. Why would they give that kind of thing to the UFO community of all places?
Yeah. So two things. One is Doty was very clear that like anything he did was coming from above, right? Like he wasn't coming up with these things and sending them on. Like he would get a mission and information. So it was being manufactured by, you know, probably Air Force intelligence. You know, I think that's sort of the question is, why did they do it this way? I think it's pretty clear that, you know, this is, again, it's during the Cold War when a lot of this stuff was going on, late 70s, 80s, early 90s, I guess. Early 90s is past the Cold War, but late 70s, early, mid 80s. And there was concern that because a lot of sort of UFO hunters were going, you know, to Groom Lake, and like going up on these ridges and taking pictures and looking through binoculars and what's going on in other Air Force bases. And there was concern that what they were getting was genuinely, you know, top secret test craft, including the stealth planes. And they were concerned that particularly the Russians had infiltrated the UFO community and were trying to get whatever information they could from those people who were sort of observing these bases as intelligence. So what their plan was, we'll muddy the waters by putting in disinformation. I mean, I think there's some question about why they put in the disinformation they actually did, especially with Paul Benowitz, which is another story I get into in the podcast, seems sort of unnecessarily cruel, I guess. You know, they really took advantage of this guy who I think pretty clearly had mental health concerns, and they just exacerbated them, you know, rather than putting him at ease.
Yeah, yeah. There's the question of ethics, right? In this kind of counterintelligence operation. I think also, just personally, it's got some big, these kinds of disinfo stories, if disinfo they are, they have these big suppressed screenwriter vibes. You know what I mean? Like somebody got their job at the Air Force, right? Because they dropped out of film school. And then they go and they need to have a good thing to muddy the waters. So they're like, I remember my sophomore college script, Zeta Reticuli. Yeah, like that's, I see how that could happen. And I completely agree with your point about the unnecessary cruelty, but I think it's also a very, very good point about the strange game of bluff against bluff that occurred during the Cold War, especially when we know that if not the majority, at least a minority of alleged UFO sightings later turned out to be, I wouldn't say solidly confirmed to be secret craft, man-made, but there's compelling evidence, you know, that people were seeing stealth bombers and saying this is a UFO.
It makes me think, I mean, it really brings the conversation kind of around to the present in my mind with this somewhat underwhelming disclosure document that the government put out. I mean, there's some fun stuff in there that kind of, it really brings up more questions than it gives answers in terms of like the whole category of like secret corporate things. Like, what does that even consist of? It's so vague, it's almost laughable. But I do think that the whole like, oh, it was like under development government tech that the public isn't aware of yet, I think that's been a line for quite a long time. And I'm just wondering what you made of that document, if you were underwhelmed, if it like kind of like brought up new ideas for you or new areas to pursue, or if it just kind of felt like a bit of a deflating moment.
That's a great question, because I was sort of hoping, you know, I started working on all this stuff, and we had the timeline down before we kind of knew what was going to happen with that report. But when the timing of the report came, I was like, this is going to be great, because I'm spending this whole season kind of talking about the development of the UFO folklore and what we think we know about UFOs. And then this report's going to come out, and I can kind of tie up the series by looking at the report and talking about how sort of the assumptions that we've kind of built up over the decades kind of play into this report and the way we kind of interpret it and understand it. And then the thing came out and it's like, what am I supposed to do with this? You know, there's just not enough there to kind of tie back to all these other things that we were talking about. So, you know, I think it's not surprising that what you got wasn't definitive in any way, and that it was just, you know, I mean, in some ways it seemed to me like the kind of thing that you put out when you don't really want to do it. And you're just like, you know,
let's just
get this thing done. And I want to put it out there, so nobody's giving me that much of a hard time. So I'm just going to kind of toe the line.
The government equivalent of writing an essay about why I refuse to write this essay.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I thought I was like, you know, in 10th grade, you know, if I'd had to write something. So anyway,
you need to get Falcon on the phone, Toby.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I read it and I was just sort of underwhelmed. And I thought what would be interesting was to see how the different sides tried to kind of stake out that this was sort of confirmatory, or at least didn't disconfirm what their beliefs were. But quite honestly, and this is from admittedly like a small sample size of like people who I follow on Twitter and websites I check, it seemed like after a little bit of conversation, like it all just kind of died away. You know, I think people, there wasn't enough meat there to really sustain much of a discussion. So I think people just kind of moved on.
Well, it feels by design though, that it died away, you know, like there was all this hoopla around it and all this kind of buildup. And then the thing came out and it's like, well, this is all kind of stuff we've already been talking about for a while. It's not really much new conversation to add. So it makes sense. And you're right, Benny, that's a really good analogy. It's like a book report by someone who totally didn't want to write a book report. But I wonder if that's by design. And if, you know, we talked about on the episode where we cover this document, that there's definitely a much larger, broader report that we will never see. What do you think's in that one?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know if it would be like I do. I cover in the season the Robertson and the Condon reports, which are sort of the two big reports that came out of Project Blue Book. And what they did, especially the Condon report, was to take a look at, you know, specific cases that, you know, had sort of confounded people and tried to get to the bottom of what it actually was. And, you know, there are a few that they said, like, we can't explain this, right? So I don't know if they went to that level where it was things like the Nimitz stuff, whether they did sort of a deeper dive into that and you know, got whatever documents they could and show them to scientists and try to come to some kind of conclusion. Like, I would kind of hope that would be what they would do. Like, I don't know what else you would spend your money on if it's not to take a look at legitimately hard to explain cases. And of course, the government, you know, likes to sort of interrogate its own processes. So that might be another aspect to it, is what are we doing? Like, how are we collecting this data? What are we doing with this data? Who's analyzing it? Who's getting the results of that analysis? That kind of stuff. But like when somebody in the Pentagon, you know, gets this mandate from Congress, it's like, we want to know everything you know about UFOs. Like, I think depending on whose desk it falls on, some people are going to be like, oh my God, are you serious? Like, I have to spend my time on this.
100%.
And then there'd be other people who would be like, all right, right on. Like, I've been wondering about that myself. I mean, you know, the Pentagon's got a ton of people. Yeah. You know, it just depends on who gets it.
I would say, you know, one excellent point you just made, Toby, that I agree with totally is the love of self-examination of methodology and process, because a lot that the short public UAP report, a great deal of it, as we all know, is about methodology and equating to, if you guys really want us to do this, then we need more money. And that's, it's funny because I spoke with some friends in government and they said, you know, that's pretty common actually in the most mundane of reports. If you ask people like to measure water levels in an estuary, part of their response is going to be, bullet point seven. Also, we need more money and more time to do this. So that's, while that struck some people as odd, it's very much apparently a standard operating procedure. It's a known thing, like a format of an essay. But when we talk about this, one of the questions that I want to ask you specifically about this story, which is, in my opinion, right now the best, most in-depth and objective examination of the Rendlesham Forest incident, what do you think comes next? Like, you know, I appreciate how you said, like, there's this almost cyclical, or dare I say seasonal reporting, right? In at least British news. Do you see it linking with other things? As Matt said, there are a lot of webs tracing away from this story, right? Different rabbit holes. What would you like the audience to, what would you like them to take away from this thing that, you know, honestly, unless you're a UFO enthusiast or unless you live in the United Kingdom, you will probably not have near as much awareness of this as you will after hearing Strange Arrivals season two. So where do you think this goes, and what do we hope people get from this?
So, you know, I think there's two things. One is, this is part of like the larger theme of this season, which is, how does what we know about UFOs, how did we get this information, right? What are the folklore processes? Which is not to say the folklore, again, not to use that as a, like, it's a fairy tale, but it's like, it's information you're getting from sort of non-official sources, right? And so how did this develop? And I think what's interesting about Rendlesham and a lot of UFO stuff is that, you know, you have multiple stories, right? From the people who encountered it, you've got stories that vary somewhat, and you've got the skeptical explanation, which, you know, varies a lot from them. So in these situations where none of these explanations are taken as being the explanation, right? That's where stories can kind of morph and take on a life of their own, right? And you'll see that, and that's kind of what I try and demonstrate at the beginning of this series, is that because there isn't any settled upon narrative as being the truth, that the story grows in these different ways and it branches off in different ways. And then because the UFO stuff is such, you know, it's such a network, and there's these people who are involved in different parts of it and stuff. I asked Richard Doty about Rendlesham, and he kind of said, you know, he heard about it and he took a look at the files, and he talked to some people he knew, and it seemed legit to him, right? So he's adding whatever authority he has to this story. But I didn't follow up because, again, this was a major part of our conversation, but I kind of wanted to ask, which story, right? Are you right, lending your voice to Peniston's story or to Halt's story or to Burroughs' story? Because they're, you know, in some cases, they rule each other out. Like, you can't believe both. So, like, in the end, I kind of took a look at Rendlesham as being sort of writ small, like this larger process by which, and the way I wanted to start it to kind of give you an idea of where I was hoping to head, but we couldn't get the rights, is there was a Jimmy Kimmel had Obama on this one time, and you know they're talking, and he said, I can't remember exactly how it came up, but he said, Kimmel says, if I was president, like as soon as we were done getting sworn in, I'd like run off the stage and go back to the White House. And I'd ask somebody like, get me, I want to know what's going on in Area 51. And, you know, the crowd laughs and Obama's like, well, that's just another reason why you won't be president. And
yeah, I remember and, that.
And I was thinking, you know, what's interesting about that is nobody has to be explained what Area 51 is, right? Even if you don't care a thing about UFOs, it's just ubiquitous in the culture. And it brings with it certain you know, thoughts about government cover-ups and alien technology and all this stuff. And it's like, how did we get here, right? How did – because the government hasn't put out anything saying this is what's going on. It's all through these sort of – informal channels.
I don't want to spoil this for anybody listening right now, but you have to listen to, is it the last episode or is it the penultimate episode where Chris Carter and Glenn Morgan are on?
Yeah, second to last.
Yep. Okay. So there, I think it's Glenn Morgan's explanation of how he would write plots for some of the X-Files episodes, which mirror how a lot of the unexplainable or unprovable conspiracy theories that have developed over the years come about, where there are two truths that do exist. You can find them. They're researchable. They are real. Then you put something in the middle of them that's a lie or something you make up, and you connect it all together in a sandwich. I think he calls it a sandwich or an Oreo or cookie,
yeah,
or whatever.
Storytelling sandwich, yeah.
Exactly. And he just discusses how every episode of X-Files, a show which informed me and countless others about this subject, even though it's not real, but it forms the folklore around UFOs and a lot of these subjects, that is mirrored with conspiracy theories that are popping up from all corners of the earth about all various different kinds of subjects. It's the same way X-Files are written. Anyway, just it blew my mind. Highly recommend you check out that episode as you're listening through.
You know, just in addition to being able to talk to Chris Carter and Glenn Morgan about the work they did, what I thought was interesting about the X-Files and some of the other media about UFOs, but especially that, because I think that's, you know, that's the biggest, most influential show like this, is the way that it both takes from the existing UFO folklore as source material and then outputs this fictionalized version of it that people come to sort of internalize as sort of the new folklore, right? So I think it's like this interesting process. And Glenn actually talks about, it's a episode he does about ice cores in the Arctic, I think, where they find these worms and,
oh yeah,
and what happens. And then he says that, you know, years afterwards, people are like, oh yeah, I read the article about that you got that idea from. And Glenn's like, there was no article. I just made it up. It's like, oh no, yeah, man, it was in National Geographic. I read it. And so that, but that's how that stuff enters the realm, right? It's like you hear it and you remember the story. You don't remember where it came from. And you kind of process it as, oh yeah, this thing I read about something that happened, rather
which can be a bad thing. I mean, you know, it's not always, you know, it can certainly lead to people spreading things that aren't backed in science at all. But I think it's really interesting you point that out, because, you know, science fiction at its best oftentimes is prescient, you know, oftentimes has sort of this forward thinking attitude behind it, that things that are ultimately pulled out of the minds of these amazing creators do come to pass in some ways. And I think X-Files does a great job of kind of building on that folklore and almost at times like making it these like weird cautionary tales about, you know, certain things in society. It's interesting. But, you know, you're right. I think the way you've built Strange Arrivals as this kind of like, I don't know, it's a really interesting thesis about UFO reports being this new oral tradition that's kind of passed down and kind of gives personality and character to these like small kind of off the map locations. And I think it's really, really well done and really thoughtful, and really enjoy the show very much.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, well, this is something that I've also been super interested in. You know, we've got previous episodes on the ways in which the ways in which stories of changelings in Europe centuries and centuries ago match pretty much one-to-one with stories of alien abductions. History, folklore, these traditions, they are reciprocal. They are a two-way street. Fiction and fact talk together to get their stories straight. And this is an amazing process. Toby, I have to say, I was floored by Strange Arrivals season one, and just between us and everybody listening, I guess I thought, can this lightning in a bottle happen again with season two? And over the moon, not a UFO, but over the moon to say that is very much the case. And we hope that we've given you just enough of a taste that you will immediately pause this episode and go straight to your podcast platform of choice for Strange Arrivals Season 2. I believe the entirety of the show is out now as our fellow conspiracy realists are hearing this.
But there's a ton of bonus content coming too, right, Toby?
Yeah, there'll be a bunch of full interviews with like Chris Carter and Glenn Morgan and
Doty?
I'm not going to put the whole Doty. I can share some choice bits with you guys. There's not enough like parts. There's, you know, I would just hate for somebody to jump into it like 15 minutes in and be like, oh my God, I can't believe that we're sending people to the planet Serpo without me like being able to signpost that, you know, you got to take all this with a huge grain of salt.
Full disclosure, everybody, I am listed as an executive producer on this show, but I had exactly 0.05% to do with it. It's just awesome, man. Big fan as somebody who barely touched it.
Likewise, full disclosure, I think Nola and I both are just big fans here. We're civilians on this one. But Toby, thank you so much for becoming one of our returning guests on the show today. We're only partially joking about Saturday Night Live rules. So I think by the time you're on here five times, there is some legal requirement for us to get you a cool jacket.
And, nice.
And in the meantime, while we're waiting for that, where can people go to learn more about your work with Strange Arrivals and also your other pursuits?
Probably the best place is Twitter, which is at Toby Ball NH. My website has been sadly neglected based on all the other stuff I've been doing. But that's the best place. You can also search my name on Amazon. You can find out more about my books there.
And if you find yourself online and you would like to follow up with us as well, we would love to hear your feedback, your opinion about Rendlesham Forest incident and related incidents. What actually happened that December in the early 1980s? Let us know your take. We try to be easy to find online.
You can find us on the internet at Conspiracy Stuff on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. You can find us on Instagram at Conspiracy Stuff Show. And hey, while you're on the internet, why not swoop on over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review, and then also go over to Strange Arrivals and do the same, because it is absolutely worthy of all 5 of those stars, if not more. And if you want to not be on the internet, you can give us a telephone call.
That's right. We have a phone number. It is 1-833-STDWYTK. When you call, you've got 3 minutes. Please give yourself a cool nickname that isn't your real name, so Richard C. Doty doesn't know who you really are.
He'll get you.
Yeah, seriously. Say anything you want to. If you've got anything personal to say to us or for the show, leave it right at the end. That would be wonderful. If you've got more to say than you can fit into that 3 minutes, if you got some links or some maybe books or anything you want to tell us about, you can send us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@iheartradio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
The following is a high-five moment from HighFiveCasino.com.
I won! Yahoo!
Private, put down your phone. This is the army.
Sarge, High Five Casino is a social casino. It's on your phone. Goes wherever you go. I win free spins, cash, prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. I won again.
Platoon, present cell phone. High Five.
High Five.
Casino.
Casino.
Win at HighFiveCasino.com.
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
Attention, true crime enthusiast. Searching for a way to unwind after diving deep into the mysteries that keep you up at night? Look no further.
Introducing Lazarus Naturals, your trusted companion for CBD relief. With a commitment to transparency, Lazarus Naturals oversees every step from farm to doorstep, ensuring purity and quality you can trust.
Visit LazarusNaturals.com today and discover how CBD can help you decompress and recharge for your next investigation.
That's LazarusNaturals.com.
Lazarus Naturals, your partner in unraveling the mysteries of true crime.
Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Your new home journey starts at Fisher Homes, where everything is red, white, and new. Explore exclusive summer savings and start your journey by selecting your ideal home site and your dream community. Choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans and bring your style to life at the Lifestyle Design Center. Are you looking for a quick move-in ready home instead? Fisher Homes has options for those too. Fill out a form to connect with a new home advisor at fisherhomes.com to get started today before the sun sets on summer savings.
Constantly making trips to Home Depot? Introducing Drop, the app that rewards you for every shopping trip. Earn free gift cards for shopping. Download the Drop app now and use code DROP33 to get $5 in points.